In our study this morning, I feel compelled to highlight some of the things that we've studied from 2 Samuel chapter 7. One of the things I've tried to focus your attention upon, and I hope that you bring pencil and paper to the class, or at least something to make some notes, of passages that you need to remember. We've begun our study in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, with the first promise of redemption regarding the seed of woman that would bruise the head of the serpent. And then we came down through the channels of time, past the flood in Genesis chapter 6, to Genesis chapter 12, where the character is
Abraham.
And we know that three promises were made to Abraham. What are they? Land, nation, and seed promise. And we see those begin to be fulfilled. At the time that the promise was made to Abraham, he was an old man, but the promised son, Isaac, was born when Abraham was how old? 100 years old. Yes, the promised son's name was Isaac, and when the boy was about, let's say, a teenager, the scriptures refer to him as a lad, what did God tell him to do? Go sacrifice him. That brings us to what passage in the text? Genesis 22, yes. Now everybody's remembering these, right? Genesis 22. God said, go kill him. What did Abraham do? He went to sacrifice him. After he had drawn back the knife, his hand was stayed with the angel, he'd offered the ram that was called in the bushes. God renewed his promise to him and told him, in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. Isaac grows up. Isaac is likewise promised the nation, land, and seed promise. Where in the text? Genesis 26, yes. Isaac has two sons. What's their names? Jacob and Esau. God extended the promises through Jacob. Passage?
Genesis
28. Yes, Genesis 28. Still we find that nation, land, and seed promise are enumerated. Genesis chapter 28. As we come down through the channels of time considerably further, we note that Jacob had 12 sons. God chose what fork of the family tree? Judah. Passage? 49:10. Genesis 49:10. The scepter would not depart out of the hand of Judah. Now, I want, before we're through with all this, everybody to remember all these passages in the order, because we've got them on a timeline. And that's crucial when you're trying to study with someone and teach them the scheme of redemption. You need to know these. Now, from Genesis chapter 49, verse 10, we come to the conclusion of Joseph's life, where we know that Joseph is well aware of the things that God had promised unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, his father. How do we know that? As Joseph dies, what instructions does he give to those who are in Egypt of the descendants of Abraham?
Take his body back with them.
Take his body back. They're going back to the land of Canaan. He knows that this is the land that God has promised. Take my body back and be buried in Canaan. So we know that he was placed in the tomb, he was embalmed. He was not placed in the tomb. In Egypt, his body was carried back to Egypt. The book of Exodus, what's it about? The Exodus, the coming out of the land of Egypt under the leadership of Moses. That's right. Now, as we think about the book of Exodus, we read about the plagues, we read about the Passover, landmark passage. The Passover, what chapter? Exodus. Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. That's right. And as the Passover is instituted, we read of the death of the firstborn and so forth. In that context, we learn that they crossed the Red Sea in Exodus chapter 14. And then we come to Exodus chapter 19, where they come down to the foot of Mount Sinai. And God then begins to reveal to them his law. But in Exodus chapter 19, write this down, verses 5 and 6, what does God call them?
Holy.
A holy nation. What started out with one man way back when, with Abraham, now has developed into what scholars tell us is the neighborhood of 2 to 3 million people that have now descended from Abraham. Check that out. Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6, the nation promise has now been fulfilled. In Exodus chapter 20, we read the giving of the law. That needs to go in your list. Now, in this period of time, we know that they come to Kadesh Barnea, and we read in the book of Numbers how that the spies were sent in to spy out the land. And 10 came back with an evil report, 2 came back with a good report. The 2, what were their names? Joshua and Caleb. That's right. And as Joshua and Caleb, Numbers chapter 14 is where you are. Write that down because you want that in your list of passages to remember. The people would not follow the instructions of Joshua and Caleb to go in and conquer the land, but rather bade that Joshua and Caleb be stoned. And as a consequence, what happened to them?
That wasn't Joshua 14.
Joshua, no, that should be Numbers 14. Did I say Joshua? No, not Joshua. Should be Numbers chapter 14. Write that down. Numbers chapter 14. Joshua and Caleb got the name in the wrong place. But as a consequence of their refusal to go in, what happened to them? Suffered in the wilderness for 4 years. Got a generation now that's got to die. All who were 20 years old and older perished in the wilderness. And then down the pipe, many years, Joshua and Caleb went in with those who had been younger than 20 years, and they conquered the land under the leadership of Joshua. Back up on the timeline, the time of Moses. We note that Moses told them that if you worship and serve idols, God will destroy you. And then he told them, when you worship and serve idols, God will destroy you. Passages. Him. They're all in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 4, 24 and 25, and Deuteronomy 8, and Deuteronomy 28 through 30. Now, there's a condition stated in chapter 30 of Deuteronomy, and that is, when you repent and return to the law, the commandments, statutes, and ordinances contained in the book of the law, therefore we know it was the law of Moses, when you do that, then God will bring you back into this land. There will be a restoration. So Moses tells them what's going to happen. He tells them what will happen when they repent. He tells them that there will be a restoration back into the land that God had promised unto Abraham. Now, that brings us to the book of Joshua. What's the book of Joshua about?
Taking the land and then dividing it.
Well put, because we see a division in the book of Joshua. Chapter 11, the last verse, what was it, Richard? Verse 24, I believe, of chapter 11, indicates that all of the land had been conquered. Write that down. That goes in your list. All the land had been conquered. Chapter 13 and following, chapter 12 is kind of a review. Chapter 13 and following is the division of the land among the tribes. Now, when you come to what passage does Joshua tell them that God gave you the land, all the land, you possessed the land, you dwelt in the land, not one thing had failed? Where is that? Joshua 21, beginning in 43. Write that down. That goes in your list. And then when you come to the next passage that goes in your list, Joshua tells them, not one thing has failed, all has come to pass. But when you worship and serve idols, he will destroy you out of this good land into which he has brought you. What's that passage?
23.
Joshua 23, beginning in 14 through verse 16. That's right. Now, that's the book of Joshua. And when you come to the book of Judges, what's it about? Say the Judges. I know that. But I'm looking for a little bit more. What's the book of Judges about?
The children of Israel have stopped serving God. They've forgotten all about God. And so God punishes them.
they go around that horn counting Abimelech how many times? 15 times. Over how long?
300 years.
Now, that brings us then to Samuel, who is the last of the judges. And as we read of Samuel being the last of the judges, during the days of Samuel, what do the people want? They want a king. Passage. A little further along. 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. The people come to Samuel and they want a judge. They come to Samuel and they want a king who will be like the other kings, the other nations that can go before them and lead them in battles and so forth and so on. Did I get that right, Ken?
Well, you're probably right. I always got mixed up when it came to Judges 9, 10.
Okay, let me go back. Judges chapter 9, verse 10. Okay, Abimelech. Yeah, Abimelech, we said a while ago, we list him among the judges, but Abimelech was a self-appointed king. He really wasn't a judge. Often in the list of the judges, he's listed as one of the judges, but he was a self-appointed king. That was not during the time necessarily when the people came and asked, make us a king that can go before us. That was during the days of Samuel. So I see your point there.
And he was only a self-appointed king over one area.
Yes. Yes. And it was a very brief period of time that he served as a king. It was not over the whole nation. But Saul was the first of the kings. And, of course, he's appointed by Samuel to be king over the nation of Israel. This begins in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Now, the reign of Saul and the discussion of Saul is the context of the rest of the book of 1 Samuel. We see the relationship between Saul and David, Saul and Jonathan. David and Jonathan, Saul's son. Discussed in that portion of the text. We see numerous battles that Saul engaged in. We see the decline of Saul, the sins that Saul committed. And of course, one that goes in your list, if you're making an outline, would be 1 Samuel chapter 13. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, we know that the Philistines are on the horizon, and Saul wants to know what to do. And Samuel says, go to Gilgal and wait, and I'll come and offer an offering. And what did Saul do? He went to Gilgal and he didn't wait like he should have. In fact, he offered the offering, and Samuel rebuked him and said, you've done very foolishly. And then we find another instance of Saul's rebellion where? 1 Samuel 15. What was the instance? Fighting the Amalekites. He brought back the best instead of destroying them. That's 1 Samuel 15. Now, as we continue our study this morning, we've read about the decline and the death of Saul. By the way, how did he die? He committed suicide. That's right. He committed suicide. The Philistines had badly wounded him with their arrows. And rather than to be taken by the Philistines, he fell on his sword and committed suicide. That's in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel. Now, when you begin 2 Samuel, you're beginning with the reign of King David, the appointment of King David, as it were, in chapter 2, or the anointing of King David. We find in our study the last two or three classes we've had, another major passage I want you to put in your list, 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 11 through 14. Because David sees the need, he thinks, to build a temple for the Lord. We know that the Lord has not asked for a temple. And David is not allowed to build the temple or a house for the Lord. But the Lord promises David that I will establish your house and I will establish your throne forever. Now, we have studied extensively about what that promise was. What is it that God is expressing to David
Alright, exactly. This particular passage needs to go major big time in your list of passages to remember. 2 Samuel 7, 11 through 14. Because he's not talking about establishing the earthly throne of David, like the premillennialists believe, and all the things that are going on now with Israel and Gaza and all that kind of stuff you've been watching on the news. There are people that are excited about some of these Old Testament passages. No, 2 Samuel chapter 7 has no application at all to that. None whatsoever. Because from a practical standpoint, God is through with the nation of Israel. Their purpose was to bring the Messiah into the world, and that's been done. And we can note how that the prophets prophesied how that Israel would reject God and God would reject them. And we note in Matthew chapter 21 that they were rejected as a nation. And now the nation of Israel is not physical. It's not temporal. But it is spiritual in nature. And Christ sits at the right hand of God and rules and reigns over the kingdom of God. The Israel of God, as Paul refers to the church in Romans chapter 6:16. Thank you. I knew it was verse 16. It was Romans. Galatians chapter 6, verse 16. The Israel of God is the church. Now, 2 Samuel 7. 11 through 14, we see that reference is made to establishing the house of David, establishing the kingdom of David. We noted in our study Wednesday night how that the lineage of kings followed from David of the tribe of Judah all the way to the time of the Babylonian captivity, which took place during the days of Jehoiakim, the father of Coniah, or Jeconiah, as he's referred to in the text of Jeremiah 22. The major import of that passage, write that down, if you will, in your list, Jeremiah 22, what is it, about verse 30? How that Jeconiah was to be written off as childless. Written off as childless. That none of the seed of Coniah would sit upon the throne in Judah and prosper. What does that mean about the lineage of kings from David? Stop with Coniah as far as sitting on the throne in Judah and prospering. Well, we know that's so. During the days of the captivity, there was not a king sitting on the throne in Judah prospering from the time of the captivity forward. But did that mean that the lineage ceased? No, lineage didn't cease. In fact, in the genealogy, as we read in Wednesday night study, in Matthew's account, chapter 1, we see that the genealogy continued till the time of Jesus. Till the time of Jesus. And we know that these Old Testament texts, 2 Samuel 7, 14, Psalms chapter 16, Psalms chapter 89, I believe it is, and Psalms chapter 110. These Psalms referencing the sitting of the Son of God, the descendant of David, on the right hand of God, cited by the Apostle Peter in Acts chapter 2. Fulfilled when Jesus was raised from the dead, exalted at the right hand of God, shows us that the prophecy of 2 Samuel 7, 14 was fulfilled in Acts chapter 2. A very, very important passage. Okay? So, write that down. You want to remember that when you're trying to teach somebody. Draw the arrows on the timeline. Help them to see the significance of the resurrection as it was prophesied by David in Psalm 16. Yes?
Jeremiah 22 passage. Thus says the Lord, write this man down, childless, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper, sitting on the throne of David, ruling again in Judah. There's a very contradiction. If he's childless, he doesn't have any descendants.
Okay.
Is it just saying childless from the standpoint of the king?
Yes. Write him off as childless.
Doesn't mean he didn't have any children. Doesn't mean he didn't have any descendants. But as far as his kingship is concerned, you mark him off.
Kingdom of Judah and Israel.
Yes, as far as a kingdom is concerned. Now, that brings us to the period of the Restoration, but we know during the time of the Restoration, though the temple was rebuilt, there really wasn't a palace and a king and so forth of the lineage of David enthroned in Judah ever again.
Well, they were just a province
of
the nation up until the
time of Christ. That's right.
So,
that's right. And when this passage from Joel is quoted, Amos chapter 9 is quoted by James in Acts chapter 15 regarding restoring the tabernacle of David. We see reference to what was said here in 2 Samuel 7, verse 14, that would include the Gentiles as a part of this kingdom. Now, these are all some pretty major things I want you to be aware of as far as the scheme of redemption is concerned. Now, I asked a while ago if I should put up charts dealing with Solomon, and Lynn said, oh no, we won't ever get through with David today, and we won't if I don't get started. But what I want you to see beyond 2 Samuel 7 is you come to 2 Samuel chapter 8. And in 2 Samuel chapter 8, we begin to read then of the triumphs of David. Look, if you will, in 2 Samuel chapter 8, beginning at verse 1. It says, "And after this it came to pass that David smote the Philistines and subdued them. And David took the bridle of the mother city out of the hand of the Philistines, and he smote Moab, and measured them with a line, making them to lie down on the ground. And he measured two lines to put to death, and one full line to keep alive. He killed two-thirds of them, nearly destroyed Moab." It says, "And the Moabites became servants to David and brought tribute. David also smote Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah. And he went to recover his dominion at the river." What river? The river Euphrates. Now, I got a map, I believe, the very next chart that we're going to look at and see the extent of the kingdom, and note that it was the extent that God had promised unto Abraham way back over in the book of Genesis, in Genesis chapter 15, beginning in verse 18. You might like to take a look at that and note that the land that was promised to Abraham was from the river Euphrates to the river of Egypt. And he began to identify some of those who were then the inhabitants of that land. But David killed the Moabites. He killed the Edomites and made them in subjection to him and put garrisons in Edom. And it tells us in verse 14, they became servants to David. And Jehovah gave great victory to David wherever he went. Now, in 2 Samuel chapter 9, I don't have this chapter on the chart, but you need to know what's in this chapter. You remember what was the relationship between David and Jonathan, Saul's son. They were real close, the very best of friends. And we note that Jonathan had a son. He was all crippled up in his feet. What was his name?
Mephibosheth.
That's right. And we know that Jonathan and David had made a covenant, and David had agreed that he would take care of Mephibosheth. Hard for me to say. Mephibosheth. And you'll note that he does so, expresses kindness in the ninth chapter, and takes care of Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth. Well, in the tenth chapter of 2 Samuel, you'll note that the Ammonites create an uprising against David. And what does David do with the Ammonites? Or he defeats them. Thank you. Well, you knew that was coming. he defeats everybody for the most part, and he defeats the Ammonites. Well, in the efforts of the Ammonites to fight against David, they want to employ the help of the Syrians. What's David do to the Syrians? He defeats them. You're good with that. He defeats them. And you'll notice in verse 18 of chapter 10, it says, "And the Syrians fled before Israel, and David slew of the Syrians the men of 700 chariots and 40,000 horsemen, and smote Shobach, the captain of their host, so that he died there. And when all the kings that were servants to Hadadezer saw that they were put to death or put to the worst before Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Syrians feared to help the children of Ammon anymore, wouldn't you? Don't want to be an ally to anybody that becomes an enemy of David because you're in trouble. And of course, that's the context of 2 Samuel chapter 10. As you see, concluding there with verse 19. Now, 2 Samuel chapter 11, we'll talk about it in just a moment, but I want you to look just a little bit farther in this text. We note that the Ammonites, we just mentioned that, had hired the Syrians to help them fight against David. And of course, they're all defeated. And David took Rabbah, and proclaimed himself king of the Ammonites. And here's my map. I thought I had it on the previous slide. David's victory. David gained victory over the Philistines. Over here, we know that he drove them back. He didn't completely destroy them, but they were no longer a thorn in his side from this point forward. And so the Philistines were conquered. The Phoenicians were conquered up here on the northern portion of coastal plain, thank you. Couldn't think of that expression. And then Hamath was conquered up here in the northern area. And we note that those who were subjected to David include the Edomites, as we read a few moments ago, the Moabites and the Ammonites, and the city of Damascus way up to the north among the Syrians. And we note that Zobah, the king was subjected unto David. So go back to that. We know that the area all the way to the Euphrates River now is being controlled by David. And of course, Solomon, we'll talk about that when we get a little bit further along. So what we want to note here is that David pushes the borders that had been invaded by these who inhabited the land that had been lost to because of Saul. David goes back and pushes them back to their respective places and defeats them. Any questions or comments just here? Well, a lot more to be said about David. Yes?
I just wanted to comment that this was not only triumph of David, but really the triumph of God over the sinful nations that he bring judgment upon.
Excellent point. When you look at the 8th chapter, verse 14, regarding the conquering of the Edomites, it says, and he put garrisons in Edom, throughout all Edom put he garrisons, and all the Edomites became servants to David. And Jehovah gave victory to David whithersoever he went. David not only was favored by God, but he also became the instrument that God used to conquer these whose, as we'll use the words that were expressed to Abraham, whose iniquity now has become full. They are ultimately subdued or conquered at this point during the reign of King David.
I brought that up because I've heard people, recent memory, but in times past, I've heard people say, well, what kind of God, you know, goes in and slaughters all people, all those people wholesale, and, you know, men, women, children. And that's really the answer, is that God gave them time to repent, and they didn't.
Well, that's right. The Amorites had, what, 400 years?
Plenty of time.
And they didn't fix their problems. God said that this will be down the pike, four generations from you, as he spoke to Abraham, because the time of the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full, but then they became much worse, and Joshua went in and conquered them. They weren't all killed, but then we read of the work that Saul was to do regarding the Amalekites. The Amalekites had been an obstacle in the path of the Israelites when they came up out of the land of Egypt. And God said, I'm going to destroy them. And so the instructions then given to Saul, kill all of them. And Saul was to be the instrument of God's wrath upon the Amalekites. And he didn't do it. And that's why Saul is accused of being rebellious. It wasn't just that command, but there was a reason for that command. He was the instrument of God's wrath, and he would not carry out the instructions that God had given.
David was the obedient servant.
That's right. Yeah. All right. Good comment. Question? Anybody? All right, let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel chapter 11. In 2 Samuel chapter 11, it tells us, beginning in verse 1, it came to pass at the return of the year, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David tarried at Jerusalem. Now, it's important that we know who these people are. Joab. Who was Joab? We're going to read about him on and off for quite a little bit. Who was Joab? The captain. That's right. The general of David's army. By the way, who was Abner? We've already talked about Abner.
Saul's
general, if we can use those terms. Saul's general. And so we want to know who these characters are. Now, Joab, the captain of David's army, he's out there fighting. And David, it tells us, tarried at Jerusalem. Where was David supposed to be? Out there with the men fighting, but he's not. But rather, he tarried in Jerusalem. In verse 2 of chapter 11, it came to pass at eventide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon. And David sent and inquired after the woman. And one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" And David sent messengers and took her, and she came in unto him, and he lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness. And she returned unto her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, and said, "I am with child." Just all kinds of things that are wrong with this. Number one, David's not fulfilling his responsibility as a king. He tarried in Jerusalem. Number two, he's looking upon another man's wife to lust after her. Some question whether or not Bathsheba should have been upon the rooftop bathing and issues of modesty and all that. Right to question those things. It was not, from what I understand, uncommon for a rooftop to be used for such purposes. However, what David did was clearly wrong. What David did was clearly wrong. In the law given unto Moses, one of the commandments was, "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Thou shalt not commit adultery." And what's David done? He knows who this woman is. He knows this is the wife of one of his soldiers, Uriah the Hittite. But rather, he sends for her. And some question whether she should have come. Oh yes, all kinds of arguments and guilt to go around. But we're talking about David. David should not have sent for her. She was another man's wife. We're talking about David's sin just here. Yes?
I was just reading through the commentary here. I hadn't thought of this before, but it turns out that, as near as we can tell, that she was granddaughter of Ahithophel, and Uriah the Hittite was one of the 30. And we see that in 2 Samuel 23. So, this was not somebody he didn't know. He committed all sorts of egregious sins by committing adultery with the granddaughter of one of his most trusted advisors and committing adultery with the wife of a man that was one of his trusted, not servants, but
soldiers.
You can say servant, I guess, but soldiers. So he wasn't just a soldier in the army. He was one of the 30.
That's right. Right. One of his most loyal men. Should have been a trusted individual.
And David was married.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we haven't said anything about that, have we?
Several.
Well, yeah, several times. We've talked about how many wives David had before Bathsheba. Yes.
Knowing at this spot here, he gets others involved in his sins.
He does.
Once he sins to get her, and then later on, people in the army, and he gets them involved.
That's right. Trying to cover it all up. Of course, he's king, and he has a political maneuver to maintain, which he attempts to do. But yes, all of that in 2 Samuel chapter 11. Well, we note that he commits fornication with this woman, and she becomes with child. Now we've got a problem. What are we going to do about it? Well, what do politicians do when they commit grievous sins? Try to cover it up. And that's what David tried to do. Tried to cover it up. Well, he sends for Uriah to come in from the battlefield. And just to kind of abbreviate some of the text here, we note that Uriah comes in from the battlefield, and David's instruction to him in verse 8 is, "Go down to thy house and wash thy feet." And Uriah departed out of the king's house, and there followed him a mess of food from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house. Did he go home? Didn't go home. Why didn't he go home? All right, Uriah is a man of honor, you see. He's loyal to the king. He's loyal to his fellow soldiers. He doesn't go home and enjoy the pleasures of his wife and the pleasures and comforts of his house. He sleeps on the king's doorstep. And when David discovers that he has slept on his doorstep, he brings him back and he says, in essence, eat, drink, and be merry. In verse 11, it says, Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah abide in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants and my lord are encamped in the open field. Shall I then go into my house and eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As thou livest and as thy soul liveth, I will not do this thing." And David said to Uriah, "Tarry here today also, and tomorrow I will let thee depart." So Uriah abode in Jerusalem that day and the morrow. And when David had called him, he did eat and drink before him, and he made him drunk. Why did he make him drunk? So he, in a drunken stupor, maybe think he would stumble home and lie with his wife and think that the child then that was conceived was his own. But this is an effort on David's part to cover up what David did. Well, again, Uriah, even in a drunken stupor, would not go home. What are we going to do with Uriah? We're going to kill him. Yeah. One of my most trusted soldiers, loyal friend, going to kill him. Cover up my sin, you see. Well, we know that all of David's efforts have failed so far, and so he calls Uriah in, and he writes a letter and puts it in the hand of Uriah the Hittite and sends him into the battlefield. And what does the letter say, Ken?
It says to put him up in front where there's going to be a better chance for him to die.
Oh, well, that's honorable, isn't it? Put him right up there in the heat of the battle and then withdraw from him. So he'll be up there all by himself. And after all, he might die. Well, if you'll notice in verse 17, it says, "And the men of the city went out and fought with Joab, and there fell some of the people, even of the servants of David, and Uriah the Hittite died also." So you see, we don't have Uriah up there simply all by himself to get killed, but we find that the army has put him in the front and withdrawn, but he's not the only one that dies. Do you see that? You made an interesting observation there, David, that David, the king, has involved a whole lot of people in his cover-up scheme. And here are some who die in addition to Uriah to try to cover up what David has done. Well, we note that David is... told about what happened to Uriah. And in verse 22, it says, "So the messenger went and came and showed David all that Joab had sent for him. And the messenger said unto David, the men prevailed against us and came out unto us into the field, and we were upon them even unto the entrance of the gate. And the shooters shot at thy servants from off the wall, and some of the king's servants are dead. And thy servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also." Can you picture that? What they've done, or what David has done with Uriah the Hittite? We're studying in 2 Samuel chapter 11 regarding the sin of David with Bathsheba and his efforts to cover that up in 2 Samuel chapter 11. Now, when you engage a city in battle, we've discussed this before regarding the various city-states that existed in much of this country, and we know that one of the things that the cities would do is would erect the wall. And to attack the city, you try to bombard the wall or gain entrance to the wall, through the wall, or burn the gates or some way to get into the city. Sometimes they would simply encompass the city and starve them out, or disease would be tossed into the city in the form of a dead body or such things to try to conquer the city. But on this particular instance, according to the instructions of David, they were in essence to charge the wall and then back away. Well, now you know what happens when you're being shot at with bows and arrows. If you stay way out yonder somewhere, you're per se. Arrow can only travel so far. But if you get close to the wall, what are the archers doing? They're shooting right at you. And there's Uriah. Yes, sir.
When they lay siege to a city, such as walls, what they try to primarily do is build a wedge of dirt to the wall so they can go up the wall and over it, mm-hmm. like an incline.
Yeah.
And thus the people in front were always getting shot, and that's where you put the slaves and the people you didn't care for up front. So they'd be killed and then actually build the wall. And sometimes that would take them half a year, year and a half.
Whatever, yeah.
To siege it while the city's cut off. That was before the siege engines of Rome, but they did this.
They did that.
That's where the heat of the battle was.
That's it. And that's right where Uriah was placed.
I find it interesting that in that case, David isn't any better than Saul, because Saul tried to do the same thing to David.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. All right. So this is what David did to try to cover up his sin. Put Uriah in the forefront of the battle, where he would be killed. Well, certainly Uriah was killed. And in verse 25, if you look again at the text, it says, "Then David said unto the messengers, Thus shalt thou say unto Joab, Let not this thing displease thee, for the sword devoureth one as well as another. Make thy battle more strong against the city, and overthrow it, and encourage thou him." Now, let's go back and enumerate some of the things that David has done. He's lusted after another man's wife. He's committed adultery with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. He's brought Uriah down out of the battle to try to deceive Uriah the Hittite to go home and then believe that the child that's conceived is his own. When that didn't work, David then devised a plot essentially to murder Uriah. And then when Uriah is dead, David just explains it all away by saying, you know, one dies in battle just like another. No big deal. Make strong your battle and take the city. He plays the hypocrite. This was not just the result of some event of war. This was a deliberate plan for Uriah to be slain to cover up David's sin. Now, in the 12th chapter, we want to talk about that some more, but any question or comment just here while we're at a breaking point?
Did David take guys on vacation or something? I mean, you know, this kind of makes it seem that it's always going to be a paid reaper
at the end. Yes, yes. Well, we know that in verse 26, Bathsheba made great lamentation for her husband. But when her mourning was past, verse 27 tells us that David sent and took her home to his house, and she became his wife, and bare him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased Jehovah. Now, you're right about that. There's going to be severe consequences that'll last for many, many years to the thing that David has done.
Just to have it also, verse 25. More literal translation says the sword devours. One, you know, it's indiscriminately. The word devour is interesting because they did some archaeological research in some of the ancient civilizations had animals on the hilt of their swords, like their mouth was biting you, and the blade would come out of the mouth.
That's interesting.
And thus, the sword would devour. confused.
Yeah.
And the Septuagint translates it that way, which I think is kind of
interesting. That is kind of interesting. I didn't know that. Excellent. Didn't know that. Any other comment? All right. When we get into the 12th chapter, Nathan the prophet comes to David and he has a story for David. Now, I know the clock's about to run out. But what, in essence, is the story, Randy, that Nathan tells David? All right. Man had a sheep. Poor man. Well, you could. I'd like you just tell me the story.
poor man with one lamb and a rich man with a huge flock of lambs. When he had company come visit, instead of killing one of his own lambs, he killed the one man's poor lamb. The poor man's one lamb and fed it to his company.
All right. How did David react to that?
He said that man should be killed.
All right. Chris, I see your hand. Okay. And so David was upset about that and said that the man were worthy to die, verse 5. And that he should restore the lamb fourfold because he'd done this thing and had no pity. What did Nathan say? The stinging words.
Thou art the man.
Thou art the man. Now that hits home, don't it? Thou art the man. Well, how did David react to that? God told him, if you'll note in verse 7, I anointed thee king over Israel and delivered thee out of the hand of Saul and gave thee thy master's house and thy master's wives into thy bosom and gave thee the house of Israel and of Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added unto thee such and such thing. One thing I understand to be a practice at that time was when a man gained victory over another nation, often he would take the wives of the king of that nation, which we've seen previously in the life of David. So God did this. And we note in verse 8, if that had not been enough, he said, I would have given you such and such things. I would have given you a whole lot more. But it says, wherefore thou hast despised the word of Jehovah to do that which is evil in his sight. Thou hast smitten Uriah the Hittite with the sword and hast taken his wife to be thy wife, and has slain him with the sword of the children of Ammon. Now therefore, the sword shall never depart out of the house, out of thy house. I'm out of time.
Yep.
Well, before I get into verse 10 and through 12, I want to note that God has accused David of killing Uriah the Hittite with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, though he was killed in battle, David, you did it because you arranged for this to happen. I want to talk with you next time about the consequences that were imposed upon David as a result of the sin that he committed. Begin reading there in chapter 12 and read on through 2 Samuel. Okay? These consequences last for a long, long time. And we'll talk about them as we pursue our study Wednesday night. 2 Samuel chapter 12 forward.